This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of No Exit by Taylor Adams, performed by Sarah Naughton. Sent, 12:23, 6:52 p.m. To FatKenny1964 at Outlook.com. From AMagicMan13 at gmail.com. We'll do it tonight. Then we'll need a place to sleep for a few weeks. And I need to know, for sure, that you're good for what we talked about. Send me the numbers, then delete this email, and I'll delete yours. I'm stuck out in a rest stop in nowhere, Colorado. The blizzard is getting worse, and I'm about to do something that can't be undone. Oh, and Merry Christmas. Dusk, 7:39 p.m., December 23rd. Screw you, Bing Crosby. Darby Thorne was 6 miles up Backbone Pass when her windshield wiper broke, and that bass baritone voice was just kicking into the second chorus. It was official. He'd be getting his white Christmas. He could shut up about it now. She thumbed the radio dial, nothing else but static, and watched her left wiper blade flap like a fractured wrist. She considered pulling over to duct tape it, but there was no highway shoulder, just walled embankments of dirty ice crowding her right and left. She was afraid to stop anyway. The snowflakes had been big and soppy when she'd blown through gypsum 90 minutes ago, but they'd grown smaller and grittier as her altitude climbed. They were hypnotic now in her racing headlights, a windshield of stars smearing into light speed. Chains, mandatory, warned the last sign she'd seen. Darby didn't own snow chains. Not yet, at least. This was her sophomore year at CU Boulder, and she'd never planned on venturing any further off campus than Ralphie's Thriftway. She remembered walking back from there last month, half drunk with a gaggle of half friends from her dorm. And when one of them asked her, only half giving a shit, where she'd planned to go for Christmas break, Darby had answered bluntly that it would require an act of God himself to make her come back home to Utah. And apparently he'd been listening, because he'd blessed Darby's mother with late-stage pancreatic cancer. She'd learned this yesterday, via text message. Scrape, scrape. The bent wiper blade slapped the glass again, but the snowflakes were dry enough and the car's speed fast enough that the windshield stayed clear. The real problem was the accumulating snow on the road. The yellow lane markers were already hidden by several inches of fresh white, and periodically, Darby felt her Honda Civic's chassis rake the surface. It returned like a wet cough, a little worse every time. On the last one, she felt the steering wheel vibrate between her knuckled fingers. Another inch of powder, and she'd be stranded up here, 9,000 feet above sea level, with a quarter tank of gas, no cell coverage, and only her troubled thoughts for company. And the brassy voice of Bing Crosby, she supposed. He crooned the final chorus as Darby took a sip of warm Red Bull. Scrape, scrape. The entire drive had been like this, a blurry, bloodshot charge through miles of foothills and scrub plains. No time to stop. All she'd eaten today was ibuprofen. She'd left her desk lamp on in her dorm room, but she'd only noticed this as she left the Dryden parking lot. Too far to turn back. Stomach acid in her throat. Pirated Schoolyard Heroes and My Chemical Romance tracks looping on her, now dead, iPod. Racing green signboards with faded fast food decals. Boulder had vanished in her rearview mirror around noon. And then the foggy skyline of Denver, with its fleet of grounded jets. And finally Little Gypsum, behind a screen of falling snowflakes. Scrape, scrape. Bing Crosby's White Christmas faded, and the next holiday song queued up. She'd heard them all twice now. Her Honda bucked sharply left. Red Bull splashed in her lap. The steering wheel went rigid in her grip, and she fought it for a stomach-fluttery second. Turn into the skid, before twisting the vehicle back under control, still moving forward and uphill, but losing speed, losing traction. No, 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 she pumped the gas. The all-weather tires gripped and released in the sludgy snow, heaving the car in violent contractions. Steam sizzled off the hood. Come on, Blue. Scrape, scrape. She'd called this car Blue since she got it in high school. Now she feathered the gas pedal, searching for the sensory feedback of traction. Twin spurts of snow kicked up in her rearview mirror, lit vivid red by her taillights. A harsh rattling sound, Blue's undercarriage scraping the snow's surface again. The car struggled and fishtailed, half boat now, and scrape. The left wiper blade snapped off and twirled away. Her heart sank. Oh, shit. Now the incoming snowflakes stuck to the left hemisphere of her windshield, rapidly gathering on the unguarded glass. She lost too much speed. In seconds, her view of State Route 7 had narrowed into tunnel vision, and she punched her steering wheel. The horn bleated, heard by no one. This is how people die, she realized with a shiver. In blizzards, people get trapped out in rural areas and run out of gas. They freeze to death. She sipped her Red Bull. Empty. She clicked off the radio, leaned into the passenger seat to see the road, and tried to remember. What was the last car she'd seen today? How many miles back? It had been an orange snowplow with CDOT stenciled on the door, hugging the right lane and spouting a plume of ice chips. At least an hour ago. Back when the sun had been out. Now it was just a gray lantern slipping behind jagged peaks, and the sky was dimming to a bruised purple. Frozen fir trees becoming jagged silhouettes, the lowlands darkening into lakes of shadow. The temperature was 4 degrees, according to the Shell Station signboard she'd passed 30 miles back. Probably colder now. Then she saw it. A half-buried green sign in a snow berm to her right. It crept up on her, catching the glow of her Honda's dirty headlights in a flash. 365 days since the last fatal accident. The count was probably a few days off due to the snowstorm, but she still found it eerie. 1 year, exactly. It made tonight some sort of grim anniversary. It felt strangely personal, like one of her gravestone rubbings. And behind it, another sign. Rest area ahead. Scene one? You've seen them all. One longhouse structure, visitor center, restrooms, maybe a volunteer-run convenience store or coffee shop, nestled among wind-blasted firs and chapped rock faces. A bare flagpole, a drum-like slice of an ancient tree, a crowd of bronze statues buried to their waists, taxpayer-funded art honoring some local doctor or pioneer, and an offshoot parking lot with a handful of parked cars. other stranded motorists like herself, waiting for the snowplows to arrive. Darby had passed dozens of rest areas since Boulder, some bigger, most better, all less isolated. But this one, apparently, was the one fate had chosen for her. "Tired?" asked a blue sign. "Free coffee inside." And a newer one, stamped with the Bush-era Homeland Security eagle. "See something? Say something." A final sign, at the end of the off-ramp, was T-shaped. It directed trucks and campers to go left, and smaller vehicles to go right. Darby almost ran it over. Her windshield was now opaque with heavy snow. Her right wiper was failing too, so she'd rolled down her side window and palmed a circle in the glass, like navigating while looking through a periscope. She didn't even bother finding a parking space. The painted lines and curves wouldn't be visible until March. And she nuzzled Blue in beside a windowless gray van. She cut the engine, killed the headlights. Silence. Her hands were still shaking, leftover adrenaline from that first skid. She squeezed them into fists. First the right, then the left. Inhale, count to five, exhale. And watched her windshield gather snowflakes. In 10 seconds, the circle she'd wiped was gone. In 30, she was sealed under a wall of darkening ice, facing the fact that she wouldn't make it to Provo, Utah, by noon tomorrow. That optimistic ETA had hinged on her beating this blizzard over Backbone Pass before midnight and reaching Vernal in time for a 3 a.m. power nap. It was almost 8 p.m. already. Even if she didn't stop to sleep or pee, she wouldn't be able to speak to her mom before the first surgery. That window of time was closed, indefinitely, like yet another mountain pass on her news app. After the surgery, then, that's when. Now her Honda was pitch black, snow packed against the glass on all sides like an Arctic cave. She checked her iPhone, squinting in the electric glow. No service and 9% battery. The last message she'd received was still open. She'd first read it back on the highway around Gypsum, crossing some causeway slick with ice, hauling ass at 85, with the little screen trembling in her palm. She's okay right now. Right now. That was a scary qualifier, and it wasn't even the scariest part. Darby's older sister Devin thought in emoticons. Her texts and Twitter posts were allergic to punctuation, often breathless spurts of verbiage in search of a coherent thought. But not this one. Devin had chosen to spell out okay and end the sentence with a period. And these little details had nested in Darby's stomach like an ulcer. Nothing tangible, but a clue that whatever was happening at Utah Valley Hospital was less than okay, but couldn't be expressed via keypad. Just four stupid words. She's okay right now. And here Darby was, the underachieving secondborn, trapped at the lonely rest stop just below the summit of Backbone Pass, because she tried to race Snowmageddon over the Rockies and failed. Miles above sea level, snowed in inside a 94 Honda Civic with busted windshield wipers, a dying phone, and a cryptic text message simmering in her mind. Mom is okay right now. Whatever the hell that meant. As a girl, she'd been fascinated by death. She hadn't lost any grandparents, so death was still an abstract concept, something to be visited and explored like a tourist. She loved gravestone rubbings. When you tape rice paper against a headstone and rub black crayon or wax to make a detailed imprint, They're beautiful. Her private collection included hundreds of them, some framed, some unknowns, some celebrities. She'd jumped a fence in Denver last year to capture Buffalo Bills. For a long time, she'd believed this little quirk of hers, this adolescent fascination with death, would better prepare her for the real thing when it entered her life. It hadn't. For a few moments, she sat in her darkened car, reading and rereading Devin's words. It occurred to her that if she stayed inside this cold vault, alone with her thoughts, she'd just start to cry. And God knows she'd done enough of that in the last 24 hours. She couldn't lose her momentum. She couldn't sink into that muck again. Like Blue, bogging down in this heavy snow, miles from human help. It'll bury you if you let it. Inhale, count to five, exhale. Forward motion. So she pocketed her iPhone, unbuckled her seatbelt, slipped a windbreaker over her Boulder Art Walk hoodie, and hoped that in addition to the promised free coffee, this dingy little rest area would have Wi-Fi. Inside the visitor center, she asked the first person she saw, and he pointed to a cheaply laminated sign on the wall. Wi-Fi for our guests, courtesy of CDOT's proud partnership with Road Connect. He stood behind her. It says it'll bill you. I'll pay it. It's a bit steep. I'll pay it anyway. See, he pointed, $3.95 every 10 minutes. I just need to make a call. For how long? I don't know. Because if it's going to be more than 20 minutes, you might want to do their Road Connect monthly pass, which says it's only $10 for... Holy shit, dude, it's fine. Darby hadn't meant to snap. She hadn't gotten a good look at this stranger until now, under the sterile fluorescent lights. Late 50s, a yellow Carhartt jacket, one earring, and a silver goatee, like a sad-eyed pirate. She reminded herself that he was probably stranded here, too, and only trying to help. Her iPhone couldn't find the wireless network anyway. She scrolled with her thumb, waiting for it to appear. Nothing. The guy returned to his seat. Karma, eh? She ignored him. This place must have been a functioning coffee house during daylight hours. But here and now, it reminded her of an after-hours bus station, overlit and bare. The coffee stand, Espresso Peak, was locked behind a roll-down security shutter. Behind it, two industrial coffee machines with analog buttons and blackened drip trays. Stale pastries. A blackboard menu listed a few pricey frou-frou drinks. The visitor center was one room, a long rectangle following the spine of the roof, with public restrooms in the back. Wooden chairs, a broad table, and benches along the wall. Nearby, a vending machine and racks of tourism brochures. The room felt both cramped and cavernous, with a sharp Lysol odor. As for the promised free coffee, on Espresso Peak's stone and mortar counter was a stack of styrofoam cups, napkins, and two carafes on warming plates, guarded by a shutter. One labeled Kofi, one labeled Coco. Someone on state payroll is 0 for 2 on spelling. At ankle level, she noticed the mortar was cracked, and one of the stones was loose. A kick could dislodge it. This irritated a small, obsessive-compulsive part of Darby's brain, like the need to pick at a hangnail. She heard a low buzzing noise, too, like the thrum of locust wings, and wondered if the site was on backup power. That could have reset the Wi-Fi, maybe. She turned back to the goateed stranger. Have you seen any payphones here? The man glanced up at her. Oh, you're still here? And shook his head. Do you have a cell signal? She asked. Not since White Bend. Her heart sank. According to the regional map on the wall, this rest stop was called Wanapaw, roughly translating to Little Devil, courtesy of the local Paiute tribe. 20 miles north was another rest area, the similarly named Wanapani, for Big Devil. And then 10 miles further, downhill, was the town of White Bend. And tonight, on the eve of Snowmageddon, or Snowpocalypse, or Snowzilla, or whatever meteorologists were calling it, White Bend might as well be on the moon. I got a signal outside, said a second male voice, behind her. Darby turned. He was leaning against the front door with one hand on the knob. She'd walked right past him when she first came inside. How did I miss him? The guy was tall, broad-shouldered, about a year or two older than her. He could be one of the Alpha Sig guys her roommate partied with a slick mop of hair, a green North Face jacket, and a shy smile. Just one bar, though, and just for a few minutes, he added. My carrier is, T-Mobile.
Mine, too. Where?
Out by the statues?
She nodded, hoping she still had enough battery for a call. Do either of you know when the snowplows are coming?
Both guys shook their heads. Darby didn't like standing between them. She had to keep turning her head. I think the emergency broadcasts are down, the older one said, pointing to a 90s-era AM-FM radio buzzing on the counter, the source of the staticky insect noise she'd heard. It was caged behind the security gate. When I got here, it was just playing traffic and ESA stuff on a 30-second loop, he added. But now it's just dead air. Maybe their transmitter's covered with snow.
She reached through the grate and straightened the antenna, causing the garbled static to change pitch.
Still better than Bing Crosby. Who's Bing Crosby? The younger man asked. One of the Beatles, the older one answered. Oh. Somehow, Darby liked the older one already, and regretted snapping at him about the Wi-Fi.
I don't know much about music, the younger one admitted.
Clearly.
On the big table, she noticed a deck of dog-eared playing cards. A little Texas Hold'em, apparently, to bond two strangers stranded by a blizzard. A toilet flushed in the restrooms. 3 strangers, she tallied. She slipped her phone back into her jeans pocket, realizing both men were still staring at her, one in front, one behind.
I'm Ed, said the older one.
Ashley, said the younger one.
Darby didn't give her name. She elbowed out the front door, back into the sub-zero chill outside, and stuffed her hands into her jacket pockets. She let the door swing shut behind her, hearing the older man ask the younger one,
Wait, your name is Ashley? Like, the girl name?
He groaned.
It's not just a girl name.
The door closed. The world outside had darkened under snow. The sun was gone. Falling snowflakes glittered orange in the visitor center's single exterior lamp, which hung over the doorway in a big pan. But Snowmageddon seemed to have thinned out for a few moments. Against the descending night, she could see the outlines of distant peaks, craggy shards of rock, half shrouded in trees. She drew her windbreaker up to her neck and shivered. The crowd of statues that the younger guy, Ashley, had mentioned were to the south of the rest area, past the flagpole and picnic area, near the off-ramp she'd taken. From here she could barely see them, just half-buried forms in the snow.
Hey.
She turned. Ashley again. He let the door click shut and caught up to her, taking high steps in the snow.
There's a really particular spot I had to stand. That's the only place I could pick up a signal, and it was just one bar. You might only be able to send a text.
That'll still work. He zipped up his coat.
I'll show you.
They followed his old footprints out there, and Darby noted that they were already half-filled with several inches of fresh powder. She wondered, but didn't ask, how long he'd been stranded here. Gaining some distance from the building, she also realized this rest area was nestled on a precipice. Behind the back wall, the restrooms, scoured treetops marked an abrupt cliff. She couldn't even see exactly where the land started to drop, as the blanket of snowpack disguised the verticality. One misstep could be fatal. The flora up here was equally hostile. Douglas firs whipped into grotesque shapes by powerful winds, their branches jagged and stiff. Thanks, Darby said. Ashley didn't hear. They kept lurching through waist-deep snow, arms out for balance. It was deeper here, off the footpath. Her Converse were already soaked through, her toes numb. So you go by Ashley? She asked.
Yeah.
Not like Ash?
Why would I?
Just asking. Again, she glanced back to the visitor center and spotted a figure standing in the amber glow of the building's single window, watching them from behind the frosted glass. She couldn't tell if it was the older man, Ed, or the person she hadn't seen.
Ashley is not just a girl's name, he said as they trudged. It's a perfectly viable man's name.
Oh, definitely.
Like Ashley Wilkes in Gone with the Wind.
I was just thinking that, Darby said. It felt good to bullshit a little, but still, the wary part of her brain that she could never quite disengage wondered. You're familiar with that old-ass movie, but you don't know who the Beatles are?
Or Ashley Johnson, he said, the world-famous rugby player.
You made that one up.
Did not.
He pointed into the distance.
Hey, you can see Melanie's Peak.
What?
Melanie's Peak.
He seemed embarrassed.
Sorry, I've been stuck here a long time, reading everything in the information center. See the big mountain over there? Some guy named it after his wife.
That's sweet.
Maybe, unless he was calling her frigid and inhospitable.
Darby chuckled. They'd reached the icicled statues now, a crowd of them. There was probably a plaque detailing what it all meant, under the snow somewhere. The sculptures appeared to be children, running, jumping, playing, cast in bronze and coated with ice. Ashley pointed at one wielding a baseball bat.
There, by the Little Leaguer.
Here?
Yeah, that's where I got a signal.
Thanks. He hesitated, his hands in his pockets.
Need me to, stick around?
Silence.
You know, I mean if...
No. Darby smiled, a genuine one. I'm fine, thanks.
I was hoping you'd say that. It's cold as balls out here.
He flashed that easy grin of his and walked back to the orange lights, waving over his shoulder.
Have fun out here with the nightmare children.
Will do. She didn't realize how unsettling the statues were until she was alone with them. The children were missing chunks. It was an art style she'd seen before. The sculptor used raw hunks of bronze, fusing them in odd and counterintuitive welds that left seams and gaps. But in the darkness, her imagination rendered gore. The boy to her left, the one swinging a baseball bat that Ashley had called the Little Leaguer, had an exposed ribcage. Others waved spindly, mangled arms, missing patches of flesh, like a crowd of pit bull mauling victims, half gnawed to the bone. What had Ashley called them? Nightmare children? He was 20 feet away, almost a silhouette against the rest area's orange light, when she turned and called to him, "Hey, wait!" He looked back. "Darby," she said. "My name is Darby." He smiled. "Thanks for helping me," she wanted to say. "Thank you for being decent to me, a total stranger." The words were there in her mind, but she couldn't make them real. They broke eye contact, the moment evaporating. "Thank you, Ashley." He kept walking. Then he stopped again, reconsidering, and said one last thing.
"You know Darby is a guy's name, right?"
She laughed. She watched him leave, and then she leaned against the statue's baseball bat, frozen mid-swing, and held her iPhone skyward against the falling snowflakes. She squinted, watching the screen's upper left corner. No service. She waited, alone in the darkness. In the right corner, the battery had fallen to 6%. She'd left her charger plugged into an outlet in her dorm. 200 miles back. "Please," she whispered. "Please, God." Still no signal. Breathing through chattering teeth, she reread her sister's text. "She's okay right now." "Okay" is the single worst word in the English language. Without context, it's an utter non-thing. "Okay" could mean her mother, Maya, was doing better. It could mean she was doing worse. And it could mean she was, well, just okay. People say pancreatic cancer is a swift killer, because death often follows a diagnosis within weeks, or even days. But that's not true. It takes years to kill. It's just symptomless in its early stages, invisibly multiplying inside its host, not manifesting jaundice or abdominal pain until it's far too late. This was a chilling notion, that the cancer had been there inside her mother when Darby was in high school. It had been there when she'd lied about the broken Sears tags in her purse. It had been there when she drove home at 3 a.m. on a Sunday night, woozy from bad ecstasy, with a green glow bracelet on her wrist. And her mother broke down in tears on the front porch and called her a rotten little bitch. That invisible creature had been perched there on her shoulder all along, eavesdropping. And she'd been dying slowly. And neither of them had known. They'd last spoken on Thanksgiving. The phone call had been over an hour of crisscrossing arguments. But the last few seconds lingered in Darby's mind. "You're the reason Dad left us," she remembered saying. "And if I could have chosen him instead of you, I would have. In a heartbeat. In a fucking heartbeat, Maya." She wiped away tears with her thumb, already freezing to her skin. She exhaled into the biting air. Her mother was being prepped for surgery right now at Utah Valley Hospital. And here Darby was, stranded at a rundown rest area, miles into the Rockies. And she knew she didn't have enough gas to idle Blue here for long. The visitor center at least had heat and electricity. Whether she liked it or not, she'd probably have to make small talk with Ed and Ashley, and whoever had flushed that toilet. She imagined them, a huddle of strangers in a snowstorm, like gold miners and homesteaders must have shared refuge in these same mountains centuries past, sipping watery coffee, sharing campfire stories, and listening to the radio for garbled clues as to when the snowplows would arrive. Maybe she'd make a few Facebook friends and learn how to play poker. Or maybe she'd go sit in her Honda and freeze to death. Both options were equally enticing. She glanced to the closest statue. This is going to be a long night, kiddos.
She checked her iPhone one last time, but by now she'd given up hope on Ashley's magic signal spot. All she was doing out here was wasting battery and courting frostbite. One hell of a long night. She headed back to the Wanapaw building, feeling another migraine nip at the edges of her thoughts. Snowmageddon had kicked up again, obscuring the mountains with wind-swept snowflakes. A sharp gust of wind raced up behind her, creaking the fir trees, whipping her jacket taut. She unconsciously counted the cars in the parking lot as she walked. 3, plus her Honda. A gray van, a red pickup truck, and an unidentified vehicle, all half-buried by rolling waves of frost. On her way back, she chose to circle through the parking lot, around this small collection of trapped cars. No reason, really. She would later look back on this mindless decision many times tonight, and wonder how differently her night might have played out if she'd merely retraced Ashley's footprints instead. She passed the row of vehicles. First was the red truck. Sandbags in the bed, webbed tire chains, less snow heaped on it than the others, meaning it hadn't been here long. She guessed 30 minutes. The second car was completely buried, just an unrecognizable mound of snow. She couldn't even discern the paint color. It could have been a dumpster for all she knew. Something broad and boxy. It had been here the longest of the four. Third was Blue, her trusty Honda Civic, the car she'd learned to drive in, the car she'd taken to college, the car she'd lost her virginity in, not all at the same time. The left wiper was still missing, tossed into some snow berm a mile down the highway. She knew she was lucky to have made it to a rest area. Last was the gray van. This was where Darby chose to cut between the parked cars and take the footpath to the building's front door, some 50 feet away. She planned to pass between the van and her Honda, leaning on the doors of her own car for balance. Printed on the side of the van was an orange cartoon fox, like a counterfeit Nick Wilde from Zootopia. He wielded a nail gun, the way a secret agent holds a pistol, promoting some sort of construction or repair service. The company's name was covered by snow, but the slogan read, "We finish what we start." The van had 2 rear windows. The right one was blocked by a towel. The left one was clear, catching a blade of reflected lamplight as Darby passed it. And in it, she glimpsed something pale inside the van. A hand. A tiny, doll-like hand. She halted mid-step, a breath trapped in her lungs. This little hand gripped a grate-like material behind the icy glass, white fingers gently unwrapping one by one in that uncoordinated way of a child still mastering their own nervous system. And then abruptly, it drew back into the darkness, gone from view. It all happened in 3, maybe 4 seconds, leaving Darby in stunned silence. No way. The interior was quiet, motionless again. She crept closer, cupping her hands against the window, squinting inside, her eyelashes fluttering on cold glass, barely visible in the blackness, near where the tiny hand had vanished. She made out a small crescent, a barely there reflection of dim sodium vapor light. It was a circular combination lock, holding a latticework of metal bars, which the child's hand had been gripping, like the kid was in a kennel. Then Darby exhaled. A mistake. And the glass went opaque with her breath. But she'd seen it. There was no unseeing it. She stepped away, leaving a handprint on the door,
feeling her heartbeat pounding in her neck, an intensifying rhythm.
There's a child locked inside this van.
8:17 p.m. She went back inside. Ashley glanced up.
Any luck?
She didn't answer. He was seated now at the wood table, playing cards with Ed. A new woman was here, too. Ed's wife, apparently, sitting next to him. She was a fussy little 40-something with a black bowl cut and a crinkly yellow parka, busily popping cartoon bubbles on her tablet. She'd been the one in the restroom. As the door clicked shut at Darby's back, she tallied three possible suspects. Chatty Ashley, sad-eyed Ed, and Ed's frumpy wife. So who did the gray van belong to? Oh my God, there's a kid outside in that van, locked in a cage or something. It hit her again, all at once. She tasted raw oysters in the back of her mouth. Her legs went mushy. She needed to sit down, but was afraid to. One of these three people did it.
Make sure the door is shut, Ed said.
Like nothing had happened, the card game resumed. Ashley checked his hand and glanced sideways at Ed.
Four of hearts?
Go fish.
Two of spades?
Nope.
Something else was wrong, Darby realized. The math didn't add up. There were three cars outside, besides her own. Three suspects in here. But Ed and his wife had almost certainly traveled together, right? So there had to be a fourth person at the rest stop. But where? She glanced from Ashley to Ed, to Ed's wife, scanning the room front to back, her heart seizing with slippery terror. Where else could... Then she felt a warm breath touch the back of her neck. Someone was standing behind her.
Jack of clubs?
Go fish.
Darby stood still, hairs prickling on her skin, a chill racing down her spine. She wanted to turn around, but she couldn't. Her body wouldn't move. He's right behind me. He was breathing down the back of her neck, a mouthy waft lifting her hair, tickling her bare skin, gently whistling past her ear. Somehow she already knew this fourth traveler was a man. Women just didn't breathe like that. He was standing less than 18 inches behind her, close enough to touch her back, or reach around her throat and put his fingers around her windpipe. She wished she could turn around and face this fourth person, whoever he was. But the moment felt strange, floaty, like trying to throw a punch in a nightmare. Turn around, she urged herself. Turn around now. In front of her, the card game continued.
Queen of hearts?
Ah, here you go.
Nine of diamonds?
Nope. Behind her, the breathing halted for a few seconds. Long enough that she briefly hoped she'd been imagining it. All of it. And then it sucked in a heavier gulp. Mouth breathing. Standing there in rigid silence. Darby realized she'd done it again. She'd entered the room without checking the corner on her left.
Jesus, Darby, just turn around. Face him.
Finally, she did. She turned slowly, casually, with one palm up, like she was just obliging Ed's request to ensure the door was closed properly. She turned. Turned until she was face to face with the man. Man was a stretch. He was tall but slouching, rail thin, 19 at most, a weasel-like profile to his acne-encrusted face, all overbite above a shapeless chin, shrouded with peach fuzz whiskers, a Deadpool beanie and a baby blue ski jacket, His narrow shoulders were wet with melted snow, like he'd just been outside too. He was staring at her, so she met his gaze. Tiny hazel pupils, rodent-like in their flat stupidity. And she returned a shy smile. The moment smeared. Rodent face's breath reeked of milk chocolate, mixed with the earthy sourness of skull. His right arm lifted without warning. Darby flinched. But he was reaching past her to press the door shut. It engaged with a deadbolt click.
"Thanks," Ed said, turning back to Ashley. "Ace of hearts?"
"Nope."
Darby broke eye contact and left the man by the door. Her heart banged against her ribs. Her footsteps sounded magnified. She squeezed both hands into fists to hide their shaking and took a seat at the table with the others. She pulled up a chair between Ashley and the older couple, and the wooden legs honked on the tiles. Ashley gritted his teeth at the harsh sound.
Nine of hearts.
Shit.
Ed's wife smacked his elbow. Language? Darby knew Rodent Face was still watching her with those dim little eyes, studying her. And she realized she was sitting rigidly, too rigidly. So she sprawled in her chair a bit and pretended to play with her iPhone. Hunching her knees up to the table, she was play-acting now. Just an over-caffeinated art major with a Honda full of gravestone rubbings and an exhausted phone battery. Stranded here at the edge of civilization like everyone else. Just a harmless CU Boulder sophomore. He lingered by the door, still watching her. Now Darby began to worry. Could he know? Maybe he'd been looking out the west-facing windows and seen her peering inside his van. Maybe he'd seen her footprints. Or maybe her demeanor gave it all away the second she'd wobbled back inside the lobby, with her nerves frayed and her heart in her throat. She was usually a good liar, but not tonight. Not now. She tried to find an ordinary explanation for what she'd witnessed. Like one of these four people's not-yet-mentioned kid was just napping in the back of their van. That was plausible, right? It had to happen all the time. That's what rest stops are for, resting. But that didn't explain the circular padlock she'd glimpsed, or the wire bars the hand had been gripping, or, come to think of it, the deliberate placement of the towels on the rear windows to conceal what was happening inside, right? Am I overreacting? Maybe. Maybe not. Her thoughts were scattering, her caffeine high deserting her. She needed some damn coffee. And speaking of overreacting, she'd already tried calling 911 outside. Still no signal. She'd tried several more times near the nightmare children, in the magic spot Ashley had described to her. Nothing. She'd even tried sending a text message to 911. She recalled reading once that text files take up a fraction of the required bandwidth and are the best way to summon help from cellular dead zones. But that hadn't worked either. Child abduction, gray van, license plate, VBH9045, State Route 7, Wanapaw Rest Stop. Send police. This text message, tagged, unable to send, was still open. She closed it, in case Rodent Face looked over her shoulder. She'd also tried opening the van's rear door, which could have been a fatal error if the vehicle had possessed a car alarm. But it was locked. Of course, why would it not be locked? She'd lingered out there, peering into the darkness with cupped hands, tapping the glass with her knuckles, trying to coax the tiny form into moving again. No luck. The van's interior was pitch black, and the rear doors were heaped with blankets and junk. She'd only glimpsed that little hand for a few seconds, but it had been enough.
She hadn't imagined it. Right?
Right. Ace of spades?
God damn it. Language, Eddie.
For Christ's sake, Sandy. We're snowed inside a taxpayer-funded shithouse in Colorado, and it's almost Christmas Eve. I'll put a 20 in my swear jar when I get home, okay?
The lady in the black bowl cut, Sandy, apparently, glanced across the wide table to Darby and mouthed, "Sorry about him." She was missing a front tooth. In her lap, her rhinestone purse was embroidered with Psalm 100, verse 5. "For the Lord is good, and his love endures." Darby smiled back politely. Her delicate sensibilities could handle a little cussing. Plus, Ashley still thought Bing Crosby was one of the Beatles, and that made Ed a decent guy in her book. But she was aware that she was developing another blind spot here, just like when she'd entered the building without checking her corners. Her gut said that Rodent Face was the driver of the gray van. But it was an assumption. She knew the kidnapper/child abuser could be anyone here. Any of the four strangers trapped at this roadside shelter could be, no, were, suspects. Ashley? He was cleaning up at Go Fish right now. He was witty and friendly, the kind of sanguine charmer she'd dated once, but never twice. But there was something about him she didn't trust. She couldn't put her finger on exactly why. Was it a mannerism? A choice of words? He just felt false to her. His social engagements carefully managed. The way a store clerk puts on a cheery face for customers, but talks shit about them in the break room. As for Ed and Sandy, they were nice, but something was off about them, too. They didn't seem like they were married. They didn't even seem like they particularly liked each other. And Rodent Face? He was a walking Amber Alert already. Everyone here was guilty until proven innocent. Darby would need to match each individual to each vehicle outside, and then she could be certain. She couldn't just openly ask either, or the true kidnapper/abusive parent would know she was onto them. She'd need to ply this information gently. She considered asking Ashley, Ed, and Sandy what time they'd arrived and deducing from the amount of snow piled on the cars outside. But that, too, could attract too much attention. Then again, what if she waited too long? The kidnapper wouldn't linger here. The instant the blizzard cleared, or the CDOT snowplows arrived, he, or she, or they, would get the hell out of Colorado, leaving Darby with only a suspect description and a license plate number. Her phone chirped in her pocket, startling her. 5% battery. Ashley glanced up at her, over a handful of grubby cards.
Signal?
What?
Any luck catching a cell signal? By the statues?
She shook her head, understanding this was an opportunity. She knew her phone wouldn't last the night, so now would be an appropriate time to ask, in character. Anyone here have an iPhone charger, by chance?
Ashley shook his head. Sorry.
I don't, said Sandy, nudging Ed's elbow, and her tone morphed from sweet to venomous. What about you, Eddie? Do you still have your phone charger, or did you pawn that, too?
You don't pawn things in the 21st century, Ed said. It's called Craigslist. And it's not my fault Apple makes overpriced...
Language!
Trash. I was going to say overpriced trash, Sandy.
He slapped his cards to the table and looked at Ashley, forcing a grin.
I broke an iPhone in my pocket once by sitting down. A $700 gadget destroyed by the simple act of sitting down. The flimsy little thing bent like a leaf against my...
Language?
Hip. My hip. See, despite what Sandy here thinks, I'm actually capable of completing an entire sentence without resorting to... Ashley interrupted. 4 of clubs? Fuck.
Sandy sighed and popped another bubble on her tablet. Careful, young man. Eddie boy flips tables when he loses.
It was a chessboard, Ed said. And it was once.
Ashley grinned, taking his new 4 of clubs.
You know, Eddie, you're never going to get another job if you don't get that cussing under control.
Sandy pecked at her screen with a thumbnail, and a cartoon failure sound chimed.
Womp, womp.
Ed forced a smile. He started to say something, but reconsidered. The room cooled. Darby crossed her arms and let the words sink in. Bottom line, no white Apple charging cord for Miles. She guessed her phone had about 90 minutes of battery life left. Rodent Face hadn't answered her question, of course, or even spoken at all. He was still standing by the front door, blocking the exit with his hands in his pockets, his fuzzy chin down, his red and black Deadpool beanie cloaking the upper half of his face. He's watching me, just like I'm watching him. She had to act natural. Her best friend had once told her that she suffered from RBF, resting bitch face. And yes, it was true that Darby rarely smiled. Not because she was bitchy or even unhappy. Smiling made her self-conscious. When the muscles in her face tensed, the long, curved scar over her eyebrow became visible, as clear as a white sickle. She'd had it since she was 10. She hated it. Crackle, snap. A ragged sound, like tearing fabric, and Darby jolted in her seat. It was the radio behind the security shutter, hissing to life. Everyone looked up. Is that?
Yep. Ed stood. The emergency freak. It's back.
Darby knew freak was Army shorthand for frequency. Another slurp of grungy static, reaching a garbled peak, like a phone dropped underwater. She didn't realize Rodent Face had crept closer until he was standing directly over her left shoulder, still mouth-breathing, joining the group in frozen attention as the ancient Sony AM-FM leaked electronic slush from the counter. Under the feedback noise, she recognized... Yes, there it was. The faintest murmur. A voice, she said. Someone's talking.
I can't hear anything. Hang on.
Ed reached through the security grate and twirled the volume dial, lifting tinny fragments out of the muck. It sounded like the automated voice, stilted with inhuman pauses.
Has issued a warning affecting black pass with blizzard conditions and extreme precipitation. State Route 7 is closed to all traffic between exits 39 and 68 until further notice.
Ashley blinked. Which mile marker are we at?
Ed raised a finger, clattering the shutters. Shh. Emergency and road maintenance crews expect significant delays of 6 to 8 hours due to multiple collisions and heavy snowfall. All motorists are advised to stay off the roads and remain indoors until conditions improve.
A long, crackly pause, then a faint beep. Everyone waited.
The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning affecting Black Pass,
the broadcast repeated, and everyone in the room deflated at once. Ed lowered the volume and huffed. Silence. Sandy spoke first.